Let's turn to the 10th chapter of Genesis. And I'd like to make it my goal to talk about all of chapter 10 and the first portion of chapter 11, verses 1 through 9. That second portion is the familiar story of the Tower of Babel. Chapter 10 is usually referred to as the Table of Nations. That's at least what Bible scholars call it. Not that anyone's under obligation to call it that. The chapter doesn't call itself that, but it's a decent label for it. At first glance, or at a cursory reading, when you look at chapter 10, you may get the impression that it's just another boring list of names. And that impression will not be altogether lost even after you make a thorough study of the chapter. Some of the names are a bit boring. A lot of the names we know very little about. But there are some interesting features, and I would like to draw as much as possible, or at least as much as I consider worthwhile, out of chapter 10 and then go on to the story of the Tower of Babel. Both of these sections, chapter 10 and the first part of chapter 11, are about how the people who lived after the flood, Noah's sons and their descendants, came to be dispersed over around the world in different ethnic and national and language groups. Of course, the story of the Tower of Babel primarily focuses on how the various languages originated, but chapter 10 tells us how the different ethnic groups arose from the three sons of Noah. And there's an introductory verse in chapter 10, verse 1. Now, this is the genealogy, or in the Hebrew, the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And sons were born to them after the flood. Now, beyond this verse, the chapter, which, as I say at first glance, just looks like a long list of names, really is a fairly organized list, and a careful reading of it will immediately disclose the organization of it, but a casual reading might not. There are three segments of chapter 10 after verse 1, and they begin and end essentially with similar headings and endings. Verse 2 says, the sons of Japheth were. Verse 6 says, the sons of Ham were. And then, down in verse 21, the children were born also to Shem, which is, you know, now we have the three sons identified, Japheth, Ham, and Shem. And the verses that follow those introductory verses tell something of who some of their descendants were of each of these branches of Noah's family. And each segment ends similarly as well. For example, the first segment about Japheth's descendants in verse 5 says, from these the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his own language, according to their families, into their nations. Likewise, after the catalog of Ham's descendants, it says in verse 20, these were the sons of Ham according to their families, according to their languages, in the lands, and in their nations. And then we have the same closing in verse 31, after telling us of Shem's descendants, it says in verse 31, these were the sons of Shem according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands, according to their nations. So, similar openings and similar closings to each of these paragraphs exist, and the other information, of course, is organized within those three major headings. Now, before I talk about any specifics, and we won't have much to say specifically about some of these names, there's very little to be said or to be known about them, but some of them there is. I had almost said interesting, but I won't profess to tell you what you ought to find interesting or not, but I would say some significant names that we should at least notice before we've passed by them. But concerning this closing statement at the end of each paragraph about these people, where it says, everyone according to his own language, according to their families, into their nations, some people in reading this have said, well, okay, we read here of various languages. Each of these people had their languages. And yet, in the beginning of chapter 11, verse 1 says, now the whole earth had one language and one speech. Now, it doesn't take much thought to resolve this difficulty, but some people don't think much when they read the Bible. They just go with first impressions. And one impression would be that in chapter 10, we've got a variety of languages and nations and so forth around the Mediterranean world by the end of chapter 10. And then at chapter 11, verse 1, you've got everyone having all one language. Well, of course, it's quite obvious that chapter 10 looks into the distance beyond Noah's and his son's days, looks many generations forward from the flood, and basically speaks about how ultimately these family trees were divided into various nations and languages and so forth. But chapter 11 tells us how it came to be that these different languages originated. I mean, in other words, it goes back. Just like chapter 1 of Genesis tells the whole story of creation, of the whole creation week, and then chapter 2, beginning of verse 4, it kind of goes back and retells part of that earlier part of the story. We have to be aware that the writers of Scripture are under no obligation to cover the material in chronological order, especially when you've got a summary chapter like chapter 10 that really tells about how the whole ancient world, at least that with which the Jews were acquainted, came to be populated from these three sons of Noah. We're looking many generations past the time of the flood. Whereas when you come to chapter 11, you go back again to the time before these nations differentiated, before the languages were diversified. And then, of course, the story is told of how they came to be diversified as they were. So I just want to make that observation only because many times I've had people, you know, wonder about that. That's not really a serious problem, I wouldn't think. Modern anthropology divides the human race into three ethnic types. Sometimes we'd say three races, but that's a little bit strange because we also use the word race to speak of the human race. And so the human race is one race, and yet using the term race in another sense, we can say there are three races, or we could say there are hundreds or thousands of races, really, depending on how particular we want to be. But there's one human race that came from the family of Noah. And there are three types, ethnic types, today into which anthropologists would divide people. It would be nice to be able to say that these three types correspond precisely with the three branches of the human family that came from the three sons of Noah, respectively, but that just doesn't work that way. Anthropologists recognize a Caucasian ethnic type, which is largely white people. I mean, essentially that's what it's referring to. Then, of course, there's what's referred to as a Negroid race, which would be the black peoples. And we usually think of the African people in that, but there's a lot of other black people in the world besides Africans. I mean, they probably migrated to those places from Africa, people like the Aborigines in Australia and so forth. Africa doesn't have the monopoly on black people, but we usually think of Africa as the continent from which the black races, where they proliferated. And then there's what anthropologists would call the Mongoloid races, which is kind of an unfortunate term since we also use the term Mongoloid to speak of people with Down syndrome, but Mongoloid speaks of Asian ethnic types, the people who have almond eyes and skin that's more of a yellow hue than that of the Caucasoid or the Negroid peoples. Anyway, these are the three basic ethnic types recognized by anthropologists. It'd be very handy to say, well, the Caucasian people came from Japheth, the Negroid people came from Ham, and the Mongoloid people came from Shem. But that just isn't true. We know something about some of the races that originated from these three guys. The list is not comprehensive. We know that they had other children and certainly other grandchildren and great-grandchildren that are not mentioned here by name. And many of the ethnic groups that are around came from some of these unnamed parties. And we'll never know necessarily which branch of Noah's family they came from. But the reason for including the names that are here is that most of the nations with whom the nation of Israel had contact are in the list. And basically it allowed the people of Moses' day, Moses wrote this, he wrote it with the concerns of his own people in mind, give them some idea of where these Canaanites and these Philistines and these Egyptians and these Assyrians came from. And it doesn't tell us, for example, where those people that we call the American Indians came from, or for that matter, the Chinese. But that doesn't mean that they didn't come from these family groups. It just means that it was not within the purview of the author to talk about those races with whom the Jews had no contact. Now, in general, Japheth's offspring seem to have given rise to Western and in some cases Eastern European peoples, which are to a large degree coincides with people we call Caucasian, although some Mongoloid people groups also apparently came from Japheth. Ham's descendants, as near as we can tell, the black races, the Negroid races, came from Ham, but so did some other races that weren't Negroid. The Canaanites were not Negroid, and yet they came from Ham. Some Mongoloid peoples also came from Ham. And the same is true of Shem. Actually, all three of these men had offspring and descendants who were a Mongoloid in ethnic type, and probably all of them had some descendants who were Caucasian. As near as I can tell, they did not all three have ancestors or descendants, who were black people. Those seem to have mainly come from Ham, as near as we can tell. But what I'm saying is, these three sons, you know, some people have pictured, well, maybe one of the sons of Noah was black, one was white, and one, you know, looked like an Asian. But that's not, you know, that'd be a very handy solution, but it doesn't seem to work. It doesn't seem to be historically accurate. Of course, the question does arise. I mean, almost all thinking people, when they read the Bible, have at one time or another asked themselves, and maybe asked someone else too, how is it that these, you know, greatly diverse ethnic groups all came from one family? I mean, Noah's family. And before that, of course, everyone came from Adam and Eve. But all the families except Noah's were wiped out in the flood. So after the flood, everyone has come from Noah's family. How is it then that we've got people who look so differently from each other from one pair, essentially, of ancestors? And the answer simply is that all of the characteristics of the human family were in the original genetic pool that God put in the human race. When God made Adam and Eve, every genetic trait that all human beings have had since then was somehow included in their genetic makeup. Not all the traits were dominant in Adam or in Eve, and maybe not even in their offspring of the first or second generation. But all those genes were in there. And at some point, as the human family, you know, reproduced more and more, some of these traits began to appear. And we don't even have to talk about Adam and Eve, since we're now talking about Africa. This is true of Noah. Noah and his wife, or at least if we included his sons and their wives, within these eight people, all of the traits that all human beings now have were included somewhere in their genetic codes. And simply as time went on, you know, the traits for black skin or for a more yellow skin or for white skin or brown skin, those traits, you know, came out in reproduction, and same thing with different hair colors and hair types and hair distribution features. And I mean, think of the diversity that we know from other biblical stories can come from one couple, Isaac and Rebekah. They had two children and they were twins, but one was as hairy as a goat all over his body. We know this because his brother, who was not hairy but was said to be a smooth man, later impersonated his brother by putting goat's hair on, and his blind father, feeling it, said, yeah, that's Esau, okay. I mean, the guy was as hairy as a goat on the back of his neck and on his arms. And in fact, the Bible tells us that when Esau was born, he was covered with red hair. The guy looked like an orangutan. And yet his twin brother had not much hair on his body and was smooth and was very different. Now, you know that if that kind of diversity can exist in one generation, in one womb at the same time from the same two parents, that it's not surprising that all the other vast differences that differentiate in different races could have come from one pair. I mentioned, I don't think it was on tape, but I think it was in a discussion after one of our earlier talks, it might have been last time, that if you would take two mulattoes, a male and a female mulatto, and a mulatto is a person who's got a black parent and a white parent, and anyone who's got one parent who's white, one parent who's black is a mulatto. Now you take two mulattoes, marry them together, if they had nine children, it has been demonstrated it is entirely possible for them to have nine different colors of children, from pure white to pure black and all the shades in between, from a single couple, just because, you know, two mulattoes together have sufficient genetic variability between them that any of those traits can come out. And we have to assume that Noah and his family obviously contained all those traits as well. It's really not any more of a problem for a Christian who believes that we all came from Noah to say that all the races came from one family than it would be a problem to the evolutionist who doesn't believe that. Because no evolutionist would argue that the human species evolved independently two different times. And therefore, the human species, if evolution occurred, had to happen at one place and one time, and all humans must have come from that original human. So whether you believe in evolution, which I don't think anyone in this room probably does, but even if a person did believe in evolution, you got a problem here, you Bible believers. You say we all came from Adam and Eve, and look at all these different colors of people. I say, fine, where do you think they all came from? You know, I mean, how many times did humans evolve separately, independently, and yet so exactly that they can reproduce with each other, so that the black human beings can marry white or mongoloid human beings and have offspring? They're obviously the same species. You can't even breed successfully a lion and a tiger, which seem not too different to us. You can get an offspring, but it won't be fertile. It won't be able to have further offspring because they're not of the same species. But for an evolutionist to suggest that humans that were genetically interbreedable, that close and that identical genetically to each other, could have independently evolved in several different continents and just happen to be different colors from each other, I don't think any evolutionist would be foolish enough to even suggest that. Everyone has to believe that the human race started originally with an original human pair. Even if an evolutionist says, well, that first human pair was simply a slight mutant living in a population of ape-like creatures that were now extinct and don't exist anymore, but were somewhat more ape-like than we are, but more human-like than modern apes are. But, you know, one of those or a couple of those couples had identical mutations so that they got a male and a female, and they start our race. Well, fine. I mean, if evolution wanted to believe that, they've got a lot more faith than I do. But the fact is, even then, they've got the same problem. All human beings came from an original pair. There's no other way of looking at it, regardless of whether you believe the Bible or have an atheistic theory about it. Now, having said that, what I've said is that the question, and it is a bugaboo that many people worry about, is, you know, how did all these different kinds of people come from one pair? It's not a Christian problem. It's simply a historical problem. You know, we don't know exactly when and where each of these different traits came into being. But one thing seems evident, that all of those genetic traits did come from originally one family. And it's not surprising, since people tend, now there are exceptions, but people do tend to find other people attractive who look a lot like themselves. It's part of our narcissism, you know. A study was done in America about self-esteem. You know, we're always told we don't have enough of it. All the studies indicate we got way too much. And one of the studies showed that the majority of people who were interviewed said that when they see attractive people, like celebrities and stuff, they tend to think that person must be a lot like them, must think a lot like them, because they tend to identify with attractive people. And when they see people who they don't think are as attractive, they tend to think, oh, that person's not very much like me. Now, you know, we do flatter ourselves. But it illustrates how we are attracted to people that we at least think are like us. And there are people, you know, who are attracted to people of other races more, but if for example, in a mixed human population, let's say at the Tower of Babel before everyone was split up, if there were all the different colors and types of people there living in one big population, leaving things to themselves, in all likelihood, people who were black would be attracted to other people who were black. White people would be more attracted to people who were white. And if that process continued for several generations, you would find more and more established racial characteristics within clans and within families. And it's even possible, though we have no way of knowing, that when God gave out different languages at the Tower of Babel, that he might well have grouped people by language who had similar racial traits as well. This is only speculation. We don't have the answers. We don't need them. I'm simply addressing the fact that it's not really a problem. It's a question that we can't be sure about its answer, but it's not a problem to believing the biblical story. Now, let's talk about these three paragraphs without looking at every name in them necessarily. The first group mentioned is Japheth. Japheth was actually the oldest brother, apparently. We were not told that before. In fact, as I recall, their names were mentioned in a different order in most of the early listings of them. In chapter 5, verse 32, where we first read of these three men, they're listed as Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Japheth's mentioned last. But Japheth was the oldest because we're told that in Genesis 10 and verse 21, where it says, the children were born also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder. This presumably means that Japheth was the elder brother of the bunch. And he is the one whose family is cataloged first for us, beginning at verse 3. The sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus. Now, we know from, just ancient history who some of these men gave rise to as far as what their clans became, ethnic groups became nations. And Gomer, for example, is known to have been a reference to the people we would call let's not go with Gomer first. Magog is the Slavs, the Mongolians, the Huns, and the Tartars. So kind of northeastern European peoples. The Slavs, the Mongolians. Now, Mongolians we think of as Mongoloid in ethnic type, but not all of these people are. The Huns and the Tartars. Gomer gave rise to the Celtic people, which would be ancestors of many of us, in all likelihood. That's another of the sons of Japheth. Madai gave rise to several ethnic groups as the generations went on, including the Medes. I don't think we have any Medes anymore, but they were, along with the Persians, the ones who conquered the Babylonian Empire in Daniel's day. The Afghans, we still know who the Afghans are today. The Kurds have been in the news a lot because of Saddam Hussein trying to wipe them out as a people. And then the East Indians, people of India, which is interesting too, because I mean they don't look very much like the Celtic people, for example, but they all came from Japheth. These people I just listed, the Medes, the Afghans, the Kurds, and the East Indians, came from Madai. Now Javan gave rise to the Greeks and the Romans. Again, many of us would have some of that blood in us, Western Europeans. And Tyrus, who's also mentioned in verse 2, the Germanic tribes in Northern Europe came from Tyrus. Now, there are some other names here, Meshech and Tubal. Identifying them with modern races is difficult. Hal Lindsey and some others have tried to identify them with people in the region that is now Russia. In fact, Hal Lindsey's tried to say Meshech is Moscow and Tubal is another Russian city, but there's no etymological reason to agree with him on that. He's just trying to prove a point that is, to my mind, not a valid one. But The point is that most scholars don't seem to point Tubal and Meshech out to be identified with any modern race that we know. But you can see that these are the people who came from Japheth, and basically they're people that are Western and Northeastern Europeans, with the exception of, say, the East Indians, who we'd call Asians, but quite a variety of peoples came from Japheth. And just looking around the room, I'd say the majority of the people in this room are probably Japhethites, more or less. Of course, all of us are probably a mixture of a lot of things now. But now, among those that are named in the first generation after Japheth in verse 2, further generations are given of two of them. In that list in verse 2, there's Gomer, and then further on there's Javan. And the subsequent verses give us a little more about those two. In verse 3, the sons of Gomer, now these are going to be the grandsons of Japheth, were Ashkenaz, Rephath, and Togarma. Now, Ashkenaz, according to long, long-standing Jewish tradition, refers to the people who are the German people, the modern Germans. In fact, the Jews who settled among those people have traditionally been called to this day the Ashkenazi, which is kind of interesting, since the Jews are supposed to be Shemitic people, but it kind of acknowledges that they intermixed with the European peoples, and there are different lines of the Jewish race. There are those that are largely from North Africa. There are those from other parts of the world, but the Ashkenazi are the ones who are the most, I guess, familiar to us. When you think of people with distinctly Jewish characteristics, well, whatever distinctly Jewish characteristics are, the ones we think of as stereotypical are those of the Ashkenazi, the European Jews. And I only say that, I'll point that out, because the word Ashkenaz is not used in modern English except with reference to the Ashkenazi. I mean, there's no group of people out there that are known as Ashkenaz, but from very, very ancient tradition, the Jews have always identified Ashkenaz as the ancestor of the German people. So again, you know, Ashkenaz was a grandson of Japheth. And then another son of Japheth, Javan, his sons are mentioned in verse 4. The sons of Javan were Elisha, not the prophet. This is much too early. Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. Some of these, Kittim, I'm not sure about this, but I think Kittim may have given rise to the Romans. But I'm not sure about that. But there, I mentioned that Javan was the ancestor of the Greeks and the Romans. And I don't know exactly how his sons divide up into separate peoples. And that's all we have about Japheth, though there certainly were many grandsons that aren't mentioned, because we aren't told of any of the grandsons of Magog or Madai or Tyrus or Tubal or Meshech. So there's obviously a lot of other groups that came from Japheth that are simply not, you know, treated. Now, when it comes to the sons of Ham, it's interesting that his line gets the longest treatment, but not because of all the names in it, but because of a sidetrack that it goes on to talk about a man named Nimrod and his accomplishments. We'll talk about that in a moment. But the sons of Ham were Cush, this is verse 6, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. Now, all of these four races that came from Ham are we're able to identify them with certainty. Mizraim is the ancient name for Egypt. Put, or Phut, P-H-U-T, is sometimes in some translations, is Libya, a North African country. And Cush is the ancient name for Ethiopia. There's not even any controversy about that. So all of those first three are North African nations, and that is why we suggest that the black races are descended from Ham, because three of his four sons are identified with African nations. Now, the only other one is Canaan, and there's no indication that the Canaanites were black, but they were related, you know, ethnically through Ham, to the North African races. But the Canaanites settled in the Middle East, what we call the Middle East, and of course were the people that the Jews had to wipe out to take their land in the days of Joshua, something much later than the time we're considering here. Now, I'd mentioned that Cush was Ethiopia. In verse 7, we're told that Cush's sons were Seba, Havilah, Sapta, Rama, and Sabtika. And the sons of Rama, one of those, so a great grandson of Ham, were Sheba and Dedan. And the reason, again, these are mentioned is because each of these became ancient nations that surrounded Israel, or that had that Israel had some dealings with or some knowledge of. Now, Cush, who was, you know, a son of Ham, had a son named Nimrod. Now, Hebrew scholars would agree that the word son does not always refer to a son of the first generation. A descendant several generations off might be called the son of somebody. For example, Jesus in Matthew 1:1 is called the son of Abraham and the son of David. Well, David is removed from Jesus by 1,000 years, and Abraham is removed from Jesus by 2,000 years. But Jesus was descended from both Abraham and David, and he's called the son of Abraham, the son of David. So we know that the word son of doesn't always have to mean a single generation. Whether it does in these lists or not, we can't be sure. But if it does refer to a single generation, then Nimrod was just two generations after the flood. Nimrod was also the one who built, apparently, the Tower of Babel. And it was during that time that God, you know, confused the languages. And we'll read about that in chapter 11. So, unless the word son is used in a sense that speaks of a somewhat more distant descendant, then we could say the Tower of Babel incident happened a couple generations after the flood. And Nimrod's the mover and the shaker in that story. And although he's not mentioned by name in chapter 11, we are told of his involvement in this little pericope that begins in verse 8. Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. See, the Tower of Babel was the beginning of his enterprise, his kingdom. And also Erech, Akkad, and Calne in the land of Shinar. Shinar is the region later mentioned in Scripture as the location of the ancient city of Babylon, on the plains of Shinar. From that land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh. Now Nineveh, millennia later than this time, was the leading city in the world. It was the capital of Assyria. And Assyria, at one time, ruled the whole region before Babylon conquered it. It was the Assyrians that carried the northern kingdom of Israel into captivity. And Nineveh was its capital. It was Nineveh that Jonah was sent to decry the atrocities of that land. Well, Nineveh, not only Babel, but also Nineveh, were apparently established by this man Nimrod. He was quite a mighty man. And that's what he's introduced as, a mighty one on the earth. He began to be a mighty one. I would point out that the mention of Babel here, in the Greek Bible, it's the word Babylon. The Septuagint has Babylon here. And for good reason, because it was on the plains of Shinar. That's where Babylon was. Babel is apparently the Hebrew form of the Greek word, or maybe the Babylonian word, Babylon. Interestingly, the word Babylon in the Babylonian language means the gate of God. But in the Hebrew, the word Babel, which is its Hebrew form, sounds like the Hebrew word for confusion. And for that reason, we're told that the tower where God confused languages is called Babel, which sounds like, but is not the same word, but sounds like the Hebrew word for confusion. But Babylon actually means gate of God. And it speaks of the aspirations of this man Nimrod. He founded the city of Babylon and Nineveh. Interestingly, at a later time, as I said, Nineveh ruled the ancient world and was later conquered by Babylon. But both cities were started by this same man, Nimrod. Now, it says, well, that's about all we got on Nimrod, but we should say some things about him because there's been quite a lot of legends about Nimrod. Some of them seem to be confirmed by other ancient documents of archaeology. Nimrod apparently had a wife named Semiramis. And there were legends that she, after Nimrod was dead, that she became pregnant by him supernaturally. Don't ask me how. But that they had a child miraculously named Tammuz. It is said that many of the practices of the Roman Catholic Church that were adopted in the Middle Ages, including the more well-known customs about Christmas and Easter, which we still see celebrated in our own culture, that these customs of coloring eggs and venerating rabbits and in the springtime, and that the idea of Christmas trees and many of the customs associated with these holidays, that they have their origins in ancient Babylonian religion, which goes back to the worship of Semiramis, the wife of Nimrod, and of her allegedly miraculously born son Tammuz. Now, this may all be true. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and proceed as if it is true on the assumption I can't prove it true or untrue, but it is widely claimed. And since none of us were really there, and probably the historical records of the period, other than the Bible itself, are not to be 100% trusted. I mean, there's an awful lot of legends that get passed down in ancient historical records. I'm nonetheless going to say, for lack of information to the contrary, I'll assume these legends are true. That would suggest that Nimrod was a pretty satanic kind of a guy. And that being so, it should not surprise us that he headed up the Babel Project. The Babel Project was conceived as an act of rebellion against God. We'll talk more about that when we get to chapter 11. But the name Nimrod apparently means "let us revolt." And it would appear that the revolt that he led was against God himself. And so he was a very wicked man. Now, the Tower of Babel was probably intended to be a religious shrine, but not to Jehovah. And there's reason to believe that it had as its object to be a shrine to the stars or to the constellations. And that there's been much claims that the modern system of astrology that gives us the, you know, the scenario for the horoscopes in the newspaper and so forth, was developed by Nimrod or by his wife and child Tammuz. Again, it's difficult to establish these beyond question, these facts, but a lot of this is discussed in a book called The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop, a book which I must confess I've never read. I have it, but I've not read it. But what I've read is people who have quoted Hislop on this. So I really don't know the status of the research behind, except that I believe Hislop is regarded to have been a credible scholar. So I only pass these things along as hearsay. What's interesting, though, is that nothing specifically bad is said about Nimrod. But because of the legends that have come down to us about him, most Christian scholars read into the narrative negative things. For example, when it says he was a mighty hunter before the Lord, well, that's a statement that's not in itself negative. I mean, in fact, it almost sounds, you know, complimentary. Before the Lord? I mean, that doesn't sound bad. But on the other hand, the term "before the Lord" might not mean having God's favor. It might simply mean, you know, God was aware of him. Everything he did, like everything everyone does, is before the eyes of God. And remember when the Bible says later in a command, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," it means in front of me. Now, it doesn't mean ahead of me. It means in my presence. You live your life before me. And as you live before me, you don't have any other gods. That's what the expression "thou shalt have no other gods before me" means. It doesn't mean "thou shalt have no other gods ahead of me, but it's okay to have some below." No other gods, period. You live in my presence. I'm the one God. And before me, where you live, you shall have no other gods, is what that command means. And to say that Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord does not mean that he had God's approval, but rather that as all people's actions are before the Lord, in the sight of the Lord. And therefore, will continually be evaluated by the Lord who's beholding them. And, you know, it makes it scary to know that if your actions are not pleasing to the Lord, but it's, of course, it's pleasant to know that if your actions are. The point is that phrase, before the Lord, does not necessarily tell us whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. We don't know if this is a value statement about him. And the word mighty hunter, certainly there's nothing intrinsically wrong with being a mighty hunter. But because, again, Nimrod has the reputation of being a bad guy, it is sometimes thought that mighty hunter is a euphemism and that he was really one who was a murderer or that he hunted people. But again, there's nothing in this statement itself that means that. All we can say is these expressions do not necessarily implicate Nimrod with any particular evil, except that he did begin the Tower of Babel, which was a bad thing. And other than that, there's not much to be said about him. He may have become a mighty one because he was an esteemed hunter. He may have originally distinguished himself among the small family of those who had descended from Noah at that time. Not too many people yet. We're only two generations off from Noah. I mean, there could be several hundred people, but not a huge population. He may have distinguished himself in his generation for his hunting exploits, especially if he brought home some dinosaurs or something, you know. That may be what happened to them, you know. Let's face it, some of them got off the ark, but they're not around now, at least not where you can see them. If they are, they're living in very remote areas where we can't see them. And something happened to him, but, quite honestly, I could imagine in an agrarian society, dinosaurs being a real pest. I can imagine some farmers putting bounties on them, or ranchers. And Nimrod may well have distinguished himself as the great bounty hunter for these troublesome beasts. I don't know, I'm speculating, but I mean, there's some reason for saying he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. And it's very possible that his skill with a weapon and some of the exploits and the trophies he brought home may have caused everyone to kind of revere him and maybe even fear him. And that may have led to his ability to, you know, negotiate for himself a position of power in the community because he became a king. The way it says it initially is, he began to be a mighty one on the earth, verse 8. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. But what kind of mighty one? Well, it says in verse 10, in the beginning of his kingdom. Well, if he had a kingdom, then he was a king. That's what kingdom is, something ruled by a king. So it's possible that he was originally just a mighty hunter that was revered and possibly feared by the rest of the clan. And he decided to exploit these dynamics of his social relationships and say, well, okay, things could be done my way from now on. I'm the ruler here. I don't know. We don't have much to go on. But there's some things there. And Nimrod is a colorful figure, both in somewhat here in this little paragraph about him, but even more so in the extra-biblical material and legends about him. Now, verse 13 talks about another son of Ham, Mizraim, which is Egypt. We have had verses 7 through 12 talking about descendants of Cush, which is Ethiopia. So Nimrod was an Ethiopian. Although there's no reason to believe that the Ethiopians were all black in those days. There are a lot of different branches of that family I mentioned here. But Mizraim, which is Egypt, begot Ludim, Anamim, Lahabim, Nephtahim. Seen many of those folks around lately, the Nephtahims. Pathrazim and Casluhim. Now, none of those seem very interesting, but of this last one, Casluhim, it says, from whom came the Philistines and the Kaphtorim. Now, the Philistines and Kaphtorim were basically the same ethnic people. They may have been called by different names once they lived in Crete originally. The Kaphtorim lived on the island of Crete. And sometime long before Abraham's time, they were seafaring people. Obviously, when you live on an island in the Mediterranean, you've got to got to have ships. And they were, a maritime people, a seafaring people. And groups of these Kafirim sailed to the coast of what we now call Israel and established 5 population centers. And from at that point, they became called Philistines. I suppose the Kafirim that didn't move there were still called Kafirim, and the ones that moved there became called the Philistines. So they're mentioned as separate groups, but they're the same ethnic group. These were descended from Ham, and they had 5 cities, city kingdoms, really, in the Promised Land. In fact, if you've ever heard Israel referred to as Palestine, you may have guessed or may not have that the word Palestine is etymologically related to the word Philistine. It was originally called Palestine. Well, I think it was originally called Canaan, but at certain times in history it was called Palestine because the Philistines, from whom the word Palestine is derived, dominated the land, even dominated the Canaanites during much of the history, and some of the time later dominated the Jews when the Jews had conquered the land. The Philistines were pretty nasty folks. They were the ones who gave us Goliath and some other giants that David had to dispatch in his lifetime. But they are very significant people. Abraham himself had dealings with the Philistines, and so did Isaac and Jacob, and then, of course, much later, 1,000 years later, David had to conquer them. And during the book of Judges, Samson messed with them. And they messed with him and found out that wasn't a very wise thing to do. But the Philistines are a long-lived people group that were right there on the property of Israel, on the same real estate. And they came, as it turns out, from Mizraim, the same roots as the Ethiopians or of the Egyptians. Okay, then of course, most important of all of Ham's descendants, from the point of view of Old Testament history, are the Canaanites. There were 7 branches of the Canaanites from 7 sons of Canaan. These became tribal kingdoms, and these were the 7 nations of the Canaanites that Joshua and his people had to defeat. But here's where they came from. Verse 15, Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth. The Hittites were called the sons of Heth. They were the ones that Abram bought his field to bury his dead in. Actually, Bathsheba was married to a Hittite before David seduced her. Her husband was Uriah the Hittite. He was a Canaanite of Heth. Who else? The Jebusite. Now, apparently this guy's name was Jebu or something, or Jebus. This is a mention not of an individual, but of an ethnic branch that came from one of the sons. The Jebusites were the people who inhabited the city of Jerusalem until David's day. In Joshua's day, when the Jews took over the land of Canaan, Jerusalem was not their capital, was not the capital of the Jewish nation. In fact, it was 1,000 years after that time. Well, not 1,000 years. It was about 400 or more years after that, that David conquered Jerusalem from the Jebusites, the Canaanite tribe that held that city. David had grown up in Bethlehem, just a few miles from Jerusalem, and had apparently all his life resented the fact that these Canaanites still had this stronghold there in Jerusalem as their city in God's Holy Land. And so one of the first things he did when he became king was lead his armies against the Jebusites and conquer Jerusalem. And David made that his capital. And from then on, it was called the City of David, or Jerusalem, which in Hebrew means City of Peace. But it was where the Jebusites were. They were Canaanites. There's the Amorite, which was apparently such a significant branch of the Canaanites that all Canaanites were sometimes called Amorites. And the Girgazites, the Hivites, the Arkites, and the Sinites, the Arvidites, the Zemarites, and the Hamathites. Now, there's more than 7 names there, but some of these were probably not of the first generation or else died off. Their branches of family died off before the days of Joshua, because only 7 tribes of the Canaanites existed in Joshua's time, I believe. It says, it's got that close. Afterward, the families of the Canaanites were dispersed. Verse 19, and the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon as you go toward Gerar. Remember when you went there last? As far as Gaza, Then as you go towards Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah, Zeboim, and as far as Laisha, Sodom and Gomorrah were Canaanite cities also. These were the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands, and in their nations. So we got some idea of where the Hamites ended up. Now, verse 21, the children were born also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber. Now, Eber is mentioned, although he's several generations removed, or at least a few, because Eber is the man who gave rise to Abraham's branch of the family. Abraham descended from Eber, and it is believed that the word Hebrew, a term that is first used in the Bible of Abraham, Abram the Hebrew, he's called in chapter 14 of Genesis, is a derivative of this name Eber, that the word Hebrew was, you know, a development from an earlier word Eberite or Eberu from the man Eber. And that is probably why he's mentioned here, when it's because, of course, Moses, who wrote this, was a Hebrew. And so were his readers. So they were mostly concerned about where they came from. And he said, well, Shem is the father of all the children of Eber, which is all of us Jews, he was saying. The brother of Japheth the elder. The sons of Shem were Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. Now, of this last man, it says the sons of Aram were Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Your name probably sounds funny to them, too. Another of these guys, Arphaxad, had some kids mentioned in verse 24. He begot Salah, and Salah begot Eber, and that's where we get, of course, the line that becomes significant after this. I would point out that Arphaxad not only, of course, is the ancestor of the Hebrews through Eber, but also of the Arabs, probably most of them through Eber also because of Abraham and Ishmael, but also the Babylonians are descent from Arphaxad. But they're not very closely related to the Hebrews, but they did come from Shem through Arphaxad, as the Hebrews later did. Elam, mentioned in verse 22, are the Persians, which would be modern Iran. Modern Iranians are from Elam. And by the way, Arphaxad, which is Babylon, is modern Iraq. Saddam Hussein is a Babylonian. Iran and Iraq are from Shem. And their ancient names were Elam and Arphaxad. Okay, now the Syrians, which were a neighboring nation to Israel, came from Aram, mentioned in verse 22. And the Assyrians, which became a mighty people, and we know that Nimrod built their capital, though apparently the Assyrians took it from him, they came from Asher. In verse 22. Now, back to Eber. Verse 25. To Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. Well, what's that got to do with anything? Well, Peleg means division. But what does it mean, in his days the earth was divided? Some have felt that maybe this is a reference to the story that follows, the Tower of Babel, where the people of the earth were divided into different language groups and separated in different ways. And that happened in the same generation that Peleg lived. Well, that would have to mean that Nimrod was not just two generations from Noah, as it seems like he was, because Eber was several generations from there. But and Peleg even a further generation from there. There's a possibility that this is true, but when it says the earth was divided, the word earth could be translated land, as opposed to sea. Land and sea. The earth mass could have been divided at this point in time if the seismic conditions associated with the flood and the breaking up of the great deep and so forth had made the earth's crust more unstable than it had been before. It is possible that the tectonic plates had begun to move after the flood, but maybe not too rapidly, maybe not rapidly enough to be discernible until some maybe rather rapid movement occurred in a particular generation, several generations later. And it could be that Eber was named division or divided because you know, one of the main characteristics of his day when he was born, his parents named him that to commemorate the fact that the earth was splitting up and dividing into separate land masses. Certainly, I believe that most geologists today do believe in continental drift, and that the continents were once either part of one landmass or at least a lot closer to each other than they are now. Of course, modern geology would assume this happened over billions and billions of years, but there's no reason to say so. I mean, no one was there. No one can say exactly when it happened. It could have happened much more rapidly than it is currently happening. And it may have begun to show itself to be happening in one generation, after, you know, several after the flood. We don't know, but there is this comment as if it is, you know, worthy of comment, something significant, that in his days the earth was divided, possibly into different language groups at the Tower of Babel, or alternatively, perhaps the actual land mass began to separate. And his brother's name was Joktan. Now, there's more on Joktan here. Joktan begot a bunch of guys, and none of them are significant to us, so I won't make any reference to him. He had a lot of offspring, but apparently no one who amounted to anything. At least no one who amounted to so much that we'd remember him 4,500 years later. Okay, and verse 30, their dwelling place was from Mesha as you go towards Sephar. It's been a long time since I've been there, so I kind of can't get a clear fix on that, but it's the mountain of the east. These were the sons of Shem according to their families, according to their languages in their lands, according to their nations. These were the families of the sons of Noah according to their generations and their nations. And from these nations were divided all the earth after the flood. Now, a shorter passage, and one perhaps with more features of interest to some. Chapter 11, verse 1. Or should we quit here? Should we leave ourselves more time to deal with the Tower of Babel at another time? Yeah, let's do that. Let's stop here. There's really nothing to be said in favor of me going on at this point, except that I said I wanted to at the beginning. But plans can change. So we'll stop there, and we'll allow ourselves to come at the Tower of Babel fresh.